This is the Marketplace Morning Report. I'm David Brancaccio. Now to Econ Extra Credit, where we revisit basic economics each week. A bunch of us are reading a free Econ 101 textbook, a chapter a week through April, from a project with the tagline, Teaching Economics Like the Last 20 Years Happened. This week, what economics tells us about all these hours we put in. Homa Zarghami is a professor of economics at Barnard College, who teaches from this book and advises this core econ project on curriculum. Welcome, Homa.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so the year was 1930. This legend among economists, Keynes, he makes this prediction, right, about how much time we're going to be working and how much time off we're going to have 100 years in the future. That's 2030. That is now 10 years from now. What does he predict?
He predicted that we would be working 15 hours a week. So we'd have a four-day weekend and a three-day work week, each day 5 hours.
You're working 15 hours a week, Homa?
I'm working 15 hours a day.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. Well, first of all, what happens, we know from economic history and the data, is that the more growth there is, sometimes fueled by technology, the more we end up working. So why did Keynes think this would peter out over these years?
So actually, while Keynes was writing, there had been a reduction in the annual hours of work. And, you know, compared to 100 years ago, we are working less than we did then.
Yeah, I mean, I heard stories. I knew my great-grandmother who worked for the Garment Workers Union in New York. And, you know, they worked enormously long hours, certainly more than 40-hour weeks. And we work less now. But we're still working a lot. So what fuels this? Why was Keynes wrong about the declining work week?
So some of the theories go back to another seminal economist, Thorsten Veblen, who had coined the term conspicuous consumption, where it's not only your absolute level of, say, consumption or income that matters to you, but your relative standing in society. And particularly if you have the people at the top of the income distribution making more money, that those consumption patterns of theirs are then going to trickle down to everybody else and set the new standard for consumption. So what you see is a very, very clear relationship between countries where the top 1% of earners earn a greater share of the total income. Those are ones where people work more. The average person works more. Also, you see similarly that as, say, the top 1% earns a larger share of income, then the average household tends to go into higher levels of debt, again, suggestive that the consumption patterns of the richest are kind of setting a bar for everybody else.
So this keeping up with the Joneses has a serious effect. At the very least, it might be persuading many of us to keep our salary as high as possible by knocking ourselves out by working all these hours.
Yeah. And part of what I often think is a little misleading about just the notion of keeping up with the Joneses is that it seems really frivolous. It seems like it's all about just having a bigger car or having nicer clothes. But I think it's actually more than that. So what happens when you have the consumption patterns being set at the top is that prices are going to go up for everybody. I mean, you can see that in housing prices and in very rich cities like San Francisco. People get pushed out of that city.
Let's just think about wanting the best for our children. That often means good schools. And if you want a good public school, that means perhaps a better neighborhood. And the houses in that better neighborhood might be more expensive. And so you got to work the longer hours just to be sure that your kids have a decent future.
Right. It kind of shows up anywhere where the goods are so limited, like there's only so many houses in that nice neighborhood where the public schools are of high quality that one has to compete in order to get in there.
Yeah, I'm also thinking of the example of higher education in elite schools, limited places. So you want your kids to get the best education so they have a shot to get into a fancy college. That may mean moving to a place where the houses are more expensive, and that means you got to work longer. Okay, I can see this treadmill of work.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, in the United States, we had a little bit more of an upswing in the last few decades in our number of hours worked in comparison to countries that make the same amount of money on average. You might think like, well, why are they getting away with working so many fewer hours per week and per year? And part of it part of it certainly has to do with the fact that in the US, we have to individually pay for so many of our services. But it also, because we've kind of fewer low-skilled jobs, I mean, education is critical these days. And so people now feel the need to devote more and more of their paychecks to putting their kids through school. And that's something that you don't have to do in some of the countries that we compare the U.S. to.
I suppose we should also note that if the work is not miserable or backbreaking, some people actually like to do what they do and don't mind putting in longer hours as an impulse to actually have the satisfaction of working. There's something in that.
Yeah, there's definitely the satisfaction to working and the extent to which we build our identities around our work that might make it so that it's not as burdensome. I don't think of my own job as the same kind of work that you're describing your great-grandmother is doing.
Yeah, no, exactly. So, I mean, there's economists would track that as well. Homozygamy is an economics professor at Barnard College. She advises the group that puts together this open-source textbook. Homa, thank you.
Oh, my pleasure.